is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth, we go right to Boca Chica, Texas, waiting for the launch of Starship Super Heavy. Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. Bob, the event was dramatic. Everybody watching on streaming, I recommend. It was a good image. SpaceX provided all of the details we needed to wait for the launch. What were we waiting for, Bob? Why that long countdown? What were they achieving in the countdown, and why did they interrupt it and then scrub?
Good evening, John. The first attempted orbital launch of Starship on top of Super Heavy, as scheduled Monday, April 17th, got scrubbed, as you say, because they said they detected what they called a pressurization issue in one of the tanks. And from what I understand, one of the tanks wasn't opening or closing as it properly should. And so they weren't getting the right pressure they wanted. And so they decided to scrub. They used the countdown as a practice countdown. They went to T-minus 40 seconds publicly, but they basically did everything they would have done on a real countdown except ignite the engines. And we have to remember that Super Heavy Starship has never been stacked before and totally fueled before, both ships. When they did a static fire test of Super Heavy, they did not have Starship stacked on top. And so this was the very first time they ever fueled both, and they were putting in a lot of methane in tanks on both Super Heavy and Starship, and a lot of oxygen on both Super Heavy and Starship. And so that's a lot of fuel, and they'd never done this before. So that they had a pressurization issue is not a tremendous surprise. We must remember that with SpaceX, when they get a problem like this, they don't just simply fix it for this particular launch. Their goal will be to figure out why it happened, fix it so that this particular problem never comes up again, and that makes them more reliable and they don't have problems later. And that's, I'm sure, what they're going to look at to see. They might not fix it permanently on this particular launch with these particular prototypes, but they will apply the knowledge to the later missions, which describes the entire point of this orbital test. Everything that happens, both good and bad, is information to apply to the next prototypes that will be launched and built, or built and launched in proper sequence. So they didn't launch. They are now scheduling Thursday, April 20th at 8:28 and a 62-minute-long window for launching. I'll have a live stream on Behind the Black, as I did before, including links to La Padre and NASA Space Flight's live streams also, so people can do multiple screens if they want. And I'll be up there watching as well, getting up for me pretty early in the morning. And it will be, this is a monumental achievement. This is really big history here. Because as I pointed out endlessly, this rocket, by the way, is twice as powerful as the Saturn V rocket and almost three times as powerful as NASA's SLS rocket. This is a big rocket. And it went from concept to launch in about 7 years, very short time, much shorter than SLS by about a third. And it was funded entirely with private investment capital at a fraction of the cost of the government's rockets. And they have a NASA contract to build a Starship that'll land on the moon, but they've gotten very little government money yet for that. That's later on in their program. This has been built by private funds based upon the concepts of free Americans coming up with their own ideas for profit. They want to make money on it. And it's going to be completely reusable, unlike those government rockets, when operational. And that will reduce the cost exponentially of getting large 100-ton payloads into orbit. If successful, it'll essentially open up the solar system for the human exploration of space. And based on SpaceX's track record, we should be very confident that they will succeed. Whether this launch will fail, there'll be an explosion, it will break up, or it won't go through as intended, or Starship will get into orbit but then will not come back down, its tiles won't do the job as well. That could happen. But SpaceX's track record is, well, we're doing an engineering test. We're going to figure out what went wrong, use that knowledge to build it better next time. And they've got prototypes in the wings ready to go, John.
This is Starship 24. I was taking notes. Starship 25 will not fly is the speculation. 26 and 27 are ready. They have an assembly line, and they're ready to continue their testing. What they want to achieve, as I understand it, is not just to set up the rocket, light it up, and see it go into orbit. They have a process called the chopsticks, and they're looking for a day, and it won't happen in Boca Chica, probably happen at Cape, in Florida. They're looking for a day in which they launch this large rocket into orbit, and the heavy, the super heavy comes back down and is captured by the chopsticks. And then what happens, Bob, once it captures the chopsticks? Do they have another starship, or do they bring the starship back down? I can't remember.
Oh, well, the whole thing is reusable. So here's what happens with the Super Heavy, and this might happen at Boca Chica during testing. They would launch the whole thing. Starship would separate, fire its engines to go into orbit. Super Heavy will do like the first stage on Falcon 9. It will come back to the ground, and they're not putting legs on it, which means it has to come back to the launch pad where the launch tower has what you call the chopsticks on it. And the way they've designed it is, and they're conceiving this, is that it will come down next to the launch tower, right next to the launch tower, very accurately, coming in between those chopsticks, and they will, chopsticks then will close in around it and capture it, and the engines will then shut off. And then the chopsticks will be able to place it on the ground gently. And then they will be able to stack a new starship on top. Now, the starship that went into orbit is eventually going to be able to come back and land vertically like a first stage Falcon 9. And so it will have a launch pad nearby, and they could either use a chopsticks, and it would land on a launch pad next to chopsticks with a tower with chopsticks. And so then what would happen is the chopsticks would come down, pick it up, and be able to move it and place it on a raw, on a transporter vehicle, which would take it then to the chopsticks where the starship is, where Super Heavy is, and pick it up. Chopsticks would pick it up and stack it again and launch. And so the idea is they'd be able to launch relatively quickly. They have a lot of logistics to work out here, but as you say, they have an assembly line, and SpaceX has made it a point to recognize that it's not design that's the most difficult challenge here. So it's difficult. The most difficult challenge is manufacturing process. Make this rocket so that they can make a lot of them in a quick succession, as well as be able to launch the ones they've got built quickly. And they got to figure the logistics out here because, as we mentioned, one of the reasons the launch is it's going to be 3 days between launch attempts is because with all that fuel, it takes a long time to unfuel it and then fuel it again. And getting the fuel into tanks nearby that they can fuel it, this is a logistical thing that's got to be worked out in order to do a lot of launches.
As I understand, though, the vision is not just one tower, not just one chopsticks, not just one super heavy and starship orbit, but many of them all lined up, blasting off and recovering, blasting off and recovering. A vast campus. That's the That was the vision I saw in a video. Is that still in place, that vision?
That's still, you know, once again, Elon Musk's goal is to be able to settle Mars. To be able to settle Mars and the solar system in general, you've got to be able to launch like an airline. And everything SpaceX does is conceived around the idea of making rocketry comparable to how airlines function. Doesn't mean they're close yet, no, but they are sure. When you look, when you watch Falcon 9 launch now, in its routine nature, they've now landed more, almost 200 times their first stage routinely now. They're getting closer, very much closer. And now Super Heavy, they're going to apply what they learned with Falcon 9 to Super Heavy. So that means both Super Heavy and Starship are more likely going to be able to reach reusability much faster than Falcon 9 did because they're starting from the bottom. They're starting already at a very strong baseline.
Commercial space. On to commercial space. Rocket Lab. What is Rocket Lab, Bob?
Rocket Lab is the one other commercial company in the United States right now that is competing with SpaceX for different kinds of launches. They have a small rocket, so they don't compete directly with SpaceX, but they're a private company with their own private rockets launching payloads for profit for both the government and private enterprise. Well, Rocket Lab has now announced that it is going to be building a suborbital version of its Electron rocket, and they're calling it HASTE. It's an acronym. I'm not going to care what the acronym means. But it, and it's designed to do frequent hypersonic flight tests. And they hope to do the first flight by their first half of the, in the first half of this year, before June. And the idea here is to provide the military a way to do hypersonic test flights, missile test flights. You don't get into orbit. You do a suborbital flight, but you're going very fast in hypersonic speeds. And so if you've got a payload that's going to use engines that use the oxygen in the atmosphere combining with a fuel, that's what hypersonic really is, you can now test this using their rocket. And this puts them in direct competition with Stratolaunch's ROC airplane with its Talon hypersonic testbed, which is being developed and hopes to also launch this year. The idea is, once again, this provides the military as well as commercial companies that want to test hypersonic flight a way to do frequent flights often in the hypersonic regimen. And so Rocket Lab competition, they saw that Stratolaunch was going to be able to get contracts for this. They said, you know what, we just adapt the rocket Electron to be a hypersonic test bed, and we can make some money. And that's what they're doing now.
Lockheed Martin, if there's any organization associated with big space, it would be Lockheed Martin, maybe Boeing, maybe McDonnell. Lockheed Martin. Now, Lockheed Martin enjoyed the bounty of the 20th century, government contracts, and always overruns. But Lockheed Martin is now going to try a different approach, a profound approach, something very similar to commercial space. Even, Bob, I think they're becoming envious of commercial space. What are they up to with R&D?
You know, John, of the big space companies, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing, Lockheed Martin over the last decade has embraced commercial space more successfully than Boeing or Northrop Grumman or any of the other big space companies. They have really made an effort as management to develop a commercial aspect, a commercial competitive aspect. For example, Rocket Lab, Lockheed Martin was one of the main investors in Rocket Lab. Lockheed Martin right now is developing its own rocket in conjunction with a small sat company called ABL. They have also moved into satellite CubeSat construction very heavily and selling that ability to the other companies. And now they're getting into doing research and development into in-orbit rendezvous and servicing of satellites using CubeSats. They have now done a successful test in orbit of two CubeSats that maneuvered and rendezvoused with each other. And these were tests, only tests. What's interesting about all this, John, and that you know, is that this is old-fashioned R&D, research and development, funded not by the government, but by Lockheed Martin itself. Before World War II, it was routine for commercial private companies to have a big budget for research and development, and that research and development would have the freedom to do almost anything with the hope they'd come up with an innovation that might produce profitable products. And in private enterprise, the idea was to encourage innovation and crazy ideas because you never know what would pay off. That commercial R&D disappeared with the military-industrial complex after World War II because basically the companies could get research and development money from the government and they would just do what the government wanted. And so very little innovation took place for almost half a century. Lockheed Martin is demonstrating that old-fashioned R&D is coming back. They're paying for this testing with the hope that they'll come up with something that they can then sell to satellite companies as a way to service their satellites. There's a lot of other companies trying to do this, but that's good. That's the competition, and it's a good thing, John.
Orbit Fab is refueling. This is gasoline alley in space. What is the innovation?
Well, that's the idea. Orbit Fab is another one of these small companies that it just raised another $28.5 million in private investment capital. That's in addition to another $21 million it had already obtained from contracts with the military and private sources. Orbit Fab's concept is to provide an orbiting fuel depot that can go to satellites and provide them new fuel. And so it is hoping to fly the first of three test refueling missions for the military next year. And it's raised, like I say, almost $50 million for the purposes of developing such technology. It is marketing its own refueling port for satellite companies. Put our refueling port on your satellite, and then we'll be able to come and refuel it periodically so your satellite can last a much longer time. They're aiming for the market like Lockheed Martin, like Rocket Lab, and like a lot of other small sat companies, John.
We go to China. Bob puts this in here just so I get to say, China's at it again, Bob. They're dumping their boosters on people, and maybe even Taiwan. Can they aim those boosters and pretend that it's just space junk falling down?
No, yes, they can. But in this case, they didn't aim it on Taiwan. They aimed. They did a launch, launching a weather satellite from their Jiaquan spaceport, which is in the Gobi Desert in the northwestern part of China.
Right.
I've got a map on Behind the Black that shows their spaceports and where this particular spaceport is located. And it appears that the flight path of that rocket and its first stage took it across China, most of China, and crossed to the north of Taiwan. And they announced, told everybody, including Taiwan, that this was going to be a drop zone in the ocean north of Taiwan. It wasn't on Taiwan, it was north of Taiwan. But of course it did disturb a lot of airplane and ocean traffic and fishing traffic. And since China doesn't provide a lot of information, they probably didn't give a very precise time about launch, so people had to wait a much longer period of time waiting for this to happen. And this is just China's way of doing things. I should point out, this is probably not all the material that was dumped. A lot of the first stage and other parts of this rocket probably landed in China on China's own people.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.